Investing in real estate on your own, going out and buying your own rental properties, is like flying a 172 or Bonanza on the weekend. Investing in a syndication is like buying a ticket on an airline with a professionally flown professional pilots.
I think it's not a bad idea. Grab a syndication attorney or somebody who's familiar with seeing these transactions and go to them and say, hey, I want to explain to you how I think this is supposed to go. And then you tell me if I'm right.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. I'm your host, Tate Duryea. I'm here with my co-host, Ryan Gibson. How you doing, man?
Good, Tate. Where the heck are you right now?
I'm on the road. My audio might not sound great. I'm on a pair of AirPods in a not so nice hotel in the Inland Empire.
Nice.
And where are you? It's 10:30 p.m. on Pacific time on a Sunday night.
Yeah, it's a beautiful Sunday night, and we had to get this episode out. So
You
we're
did.
grinding. It's 10:30. I'm in the office, and we're here recording for our listeners. But we've got a
Absolutely.
great topic tonight that or today, whenever you're listening to this, that we just couldn't wait to get out to you, and we're so excited about it. And that's we're gonna do passive investing 101.
Passive investing, syndication 101. So how syndications work, what the vehicle is, what waterfalls are, all that sort of stuff. So Ryan, you want to kick us off?
Yeah, so I, first of all, sometimes you're investing in, we as pilots, you get this 401k and you just set up the automatic deposits and you just walk away from the thing and you hope that, by the time you retire, you got enough money to pull out right at the end.
Exactly.
That's sort of like what my investing background was, right? It's like I was a really good investor because I was putting it in the maximum you can put in, and that was good, right? I was patting myself on the back for that. So, but there's so much more you can do in real estate. There's so much diversification and investing that you can do just in general. And I think what investors fail to realize, I literally just left a Delta retirement party, and the captain that was retiring, he was so grateful having run into us because he said, I never really understood cash flow.
Right.
And because I think what people do is they pile up all this money in this the retirement accounts, they can't touch anything, and then they retire and they hope there's enough there to, like, as the air goes out of the balloon until till the sunset, right? And
Exactly.
what they don't realize is they can start benefiting from investing now and start getting cash flow that replaces their income, right? We talked all about this on Jeremy Roll's podcast really well, but
Exactly.
you're now probably thinking, okay, that's great, Ryan, but like, how do we do this? Like, what is the first step? What do I need to know? Like, let's like break really break it down. So that's what we're going to do today. So excited about it.
Very excited. And cash flow investing has changed my life because having a big pile of money to retire on later is great, but to me, having a big pile of money that hopefully doesn't run out until the day you die is not a very inspiring investment strategy. Instead, if you can build a massive portfolio of cash flowing assets that throw off perpetual cash flow that you can just you literally just leave your job like a curling puck, right? You could just let it go because all of a sudden that cash flow has replaced your income, and you can then pass the underlying assets down to your kids. And so it's just this way more enlightening investment strategy, in my opinion.
Yeah, and like you may be, or you're always tempted, right? You get those green slips or you get the extra open time and you're like, man, that's a lot of money. I want to do it, but it means that I'm going to miss all these things, and the cash is too much, right? If you start getting passive income, maybe it's not as much anxiety in your life because you can just say, I've got the passive income. I don't need to go pick up this trip and ruin my afternoon of activities. So there is a litany of reasons. That might be the reason why you do passive income. It might be so that you can enhance your lifestyle, live a little bit more
Right.
lavishly. or so that you can just sort of reduce the amount that you work, or reduce the amount that you work until nothing. And so, you know, that's what doctors do. That's what lawyers do. That's what pilots do. That's what engineers or tech professionals do, is they start to invest passively in these syndications, and then it increases their cash flow. And, you know, some people set out some like really great goals. Like, I want to have $10,000 or $20,000 or $30,000 a month in passive income. And they just start to get going in the strategy. So, you know, everything that we talk about today will be in our Passive Investing 101 ebook, which will be in the show notes. So you can download that if you prefer to read. That's in the show notes for you.
Yeah, so it's excellent. I can attest to it. I have a copy of it actually in front of me as we speak.
Nice. Yeah. Everything you need to know to begin investing in commercial real estate. So Tate, why don't you kick us off? What is a syndication?
A syndication is a group of people coming together to take down a commercial real estate asset, in this case, that would be much, much too big for an individual investor to buy. So let's say $100 million apartment building, not one investor is going to go buy that, right? So a bunch of investors are going to pool money together. And that, what makes it a syndication versus a joint venture, is the fact that there is a general partner. So the investors are limited partners. They're sort of passengers on the airplane. And then there's a general partner, which are, you know, for lack of a better analogy, the pilots, right? Yep. So the pilots are the ones who are in charge of the flight. Everybody else is just sort of along for the ride and paying for it.
Yeah. And this isn't an investment in stock or bond or mutual fund. These are investments. Like, we're talking today, we're going to use the example of real estate, like hard assets. So
right,
you find somebody who's operating these syndications and you invest in their pool of cash that goes and buys and takes down the deal. So let's talk about cash flow. When you invest in properties that are generating revenue or generating income, you typically receive monthly payments, quarterly payments, annual payments. Ask the operator what it is. And this is kind of steady, predictable cash flow that help you supplement your income and provide that financial stability that you're looking for, right? You might,
right,
like we talked about earlier. So, and I think what's really neat is that people don't realize there's tax benefits. You know, a lot of W-2 high income earners go, man, I'm really looking for something to offset all these gains that I have. And one of the things that this does is it allows you to have tax benefits. And, you know, for example, you can utilize the depreciation from real estate as a deduction to shield your passive income for many years. So, you know, I had one investor at one time, I was in a new hire class, and they're like, well, your deal pays, let's say I have a real estate deal that pays 8% versus a stock that pays 8%. What's the difference? What's the advantage, right? Well, the advantage is the real estate deal is going to come with a 30, 40% tax break, and your stock is not going to come with any tax break, right? So when you're comparing the two, that's kind of a comparison.
Right. The other thing is that, you know, that stock is throwing off a dividend, but the value of the underlying asset can swing wildly with public sentiment and the market, right? Whereas a real estate asset is generally pretty stable.
Yeah. And even during this more difficult time, real estate asset values really haven't fallen all that much, especially from the run up of like 2019, 2020. Mm-hmm. So, and the other thing too is the upside potential. You know, there's no guarantees in any investment that a real estate syndication will have substantial upside, but as the property values increase over time, your investment grows over time, and that'll provide an opportunity for you to get a payout when that asset sells and goes to market. So, you know, you get the cash flow along the way and you get the big potential payout at the end.
Yep. So. Now, we did a deep dive on preferred return, I think on another episode. And I've got a blog on our website about it. If you'd like to check it out, it's called Understanding Preferred Return. We'll link to that in the show notes as well. I think it's important to note the difference between year one, two, three, four, five cash flow and preferred return. Right. So, Ryan, do you want to break down preferred return for us? And, you know, if it's an 8% pref, does that mean that I'm going to be getting an 8% return in my first year?
I would all go into assuming not. So 8% preferred return basically is just a right. It gives you the rights to the cash flow 100% until you achieve 8%, right? So exactly. If you put in 100 grand, that should net you $8,000 a year, and or about, I think, $666 a month. right? And that doesn't mean that your investment is going to perform and pay that much, but it just means that you have to get the first profits from the deal 100% until you have earned that. And that's usually an accruing daily preferred return balance. So let's just say we go a whole year, there's not a drop of cash flow, and you have an 8% pref on the investment. That means that you have to make $8,000 100% and it accumulated before there's any split with the sponsor, which is really
neat. Split with the sponsor, exactly. So when Ryan says 100%, it's a 100% to 0% split between the passengers and the pilots, essentially, right? The people that are putting together the deal, the GP. So you have to make that 8% in order to get to the next hurdle, which is likely a split somewhere in the neighborhood of like 70-30 to 70% going to the investors, 30% going to the operator.
Yeah, and Tate mentioned GP. That means general partner. And that's basically the individuals or entities responsible for overseeing the strategy of the investment and its direction. So it's like the person who's in charge. And they make the major decisions. They are basically taking liability for any debt obligations potentially. And they kind of take on a lot of risk in that regard. So GP, general partner, that's the person running the operation. Limited partners are basically you, the passive investor, who are investing in this syndication, and they contribute the capital to the investment, but have no hand in the day-to-day. So this is like 100% hands-off. You know, I always like to use the example turnkey investing. This is not turnkey investing. Turnkey investing, right. You own the real estate. Like, your name is on the title. Your name is on the loan. Like, the buck stops with you at the end of the day. You may have a third-party property management company, but like, you are on the hook. I think a lot of confusion comes into play when you're a limited partner. You're actually not going on the deed of trust or the title or the deed of the property. You are investing in a limited partnership interest in the LLC that then owns the property, right? So your liability, you have limited liability, which is really great. Now, if the investment performs well, you benefit. If the investment performs poorly, you could lose all of your capital. And if you aren't careful, you could have actually a capital call. Now, we don't have capital call provisions in our offerings typically, which is a good thing, but that's something that you want to check and say, hey, if you guys run out of money and I got to contribute more, what does that look like? How does my shares, or how are they diluted, or what am I obligated to beyond my initial investment?
Right.
And then just to kind of put a bow on this, you can have GPs, you can have like multiple general partners, and then you can also have an operator. And an operator, that's the team that's responsible for managing the property's day-to-day operations. The GP and the operator could be like different people, different groups. At Spartan, we're the GP and the operator, right? Because we hire all the management and the operations and the self-storage people and the construction and all that. So we're running the entire operation. So that's kind of, you know, kind of really good to talk about. Hey, you want to
just not lose? Just not leave anybody behind there. If you haven't heard of turnkey investment solutions for real estate, that typically is someone who essentially flips a house, puts a renter in it, and then sells it as a packaged investment. So everything has been done for you. They found the deal, they renovated it, they put the tenant in, they linked it up with a property manager, and then they just sell it. They say, here's your rental property. And those typically aren't great deals. You know, there's exceptions to every rule, but you know, if you're not the one who's finding the deal, doing the work, and actually, you know, getting your hands dirty, you know, that's where the value is created, right? So that value has already been created, and it's being, you know, the money's being made by the turnkey operator. So when we say, you know, an investment in a syndication is essentially turnkey, it has nothing to do with, you know, that style of, typically that would be a single family home investment. Anyway, just wanted to clear that up.
And then you have something called a syndicator, and Tate, I'll let you cover the fund to fund section here in a minute.
For sure.
But a syndicate or a syndicator is raising capital. So again, Spartan is general partner, operator, and syndicator. And so sometimes there's operators and general partners that go and find partners to raise the cash. We actually take it on in-house. And then there's one more kind of, before I turn it back to Tate, there's one more kind of confusing thing that you'll hear out there called a KP or a key principle, which is like slightly different than like the things that I've just said. A KP is basically they're playing a vital role in the syndication, like the general partner or operator, but they're usually, you know, they're a decision maker and they have a sizable influence on the success of the investment, but they may be kind of like along for the ride. You might hear me reference like student deals or, hey, I want to join your, you might have like a very seasoned person joined as the key principal. They might be getting like a little cut of the deal to be like an advisor almost to a lesser experienced people or lesser experienced operator. When I hear the word KP, I'm, you know, sorry about if someone's listening to this and I offend them, but I kind of start thinking there's a lot of hands in the pot and the operations, which is fine. It could be okay. But that's usually, that means that somebody's doing something that doesn't have experience and they're trying to get like experience by having KPs. I don't know, Tate, do you agree with that? Or?
Yeah, 100%. It can also be for net worth and liquidity requirements by the lender. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, great point. So sometimes if there's a big loan that the partnership needs, you know, let's say it's a $300 million loan or something, or $200 million loan, typically the borrower has to have a net worth of the loan amount, 100% of the loan amount. So it's a $100 million loan. They need to be $100 million net worth. And then they usually have to have at least 10% liquidity. So they'd have to have, in this instance, $10 million sitting in the bank. Not everybody has that. So sometimes KPs come in to act as loan guarantors and they'd be compensated as such. So again, don't take my initial reaction to that as set in stone. But when I hear KP, that means there's a lot of people kind of making the thing happen, right? And a loan guarantor doesn't necessarily have to be a key principal. That could be just somebody in the shadows that sign on a loan and take a little bit of cut of the deal. So
it's a pretty sweet position to be in when you're super rich and you can just sign on a non-recourse loan. And to be clear, you know, these loans work much differently than residential loans, where if you were to default, Ryan, if you were to stop paying your mortgage payment, the bank would come and say, hey, we're going to look for you. You personally guaranteed this note, right? So we're not only going to foreclose on your house, but if your house doesn't pay for the mortgage, we're going to go after you personally, right? Yeah. These are considered non-recourse loans. In commercial real estate, you know, if you're getting a $100 million loan, the bank doesn't look at the borrowers. The bank looks at the deal itself. So this is another, you know, point of diligence that when you're kicking the tires on, and we'll get into this more, but when you're looking at a deal, it's like, okay, well, who's the lender? Why do they think it's a good deal?
Why don't you jump in and talk to us about the fund of funds role in a syndication?
Yeah. So a fund of funds is when a group of investors come together and pool their money to invest in a specific asset. So when I got into the capital raising space, I decidedly did not want to be doing what Ryan does. Ryan has 120, how many employees?
Yeah, about 130 employees.
130? Every time I talk to you, it's a few more. So you have to be you have to be a real go-getter to want to take on the role of GP, of operator. You know, when I started investing passively, it was like, this is great. I can be hands-off and let other people do this. Now, that being said, I saw the opportunity because a lot of doctor groups have funds that pool money together from other physicians and they invest as a group. And no one was doing that for airline pilots. And I thought, you know, geez, you know, there are dozens of these groups for physicians. Pilots really need the same access to these kind of opportunities. And so I realized that was sort of my calling, was to educate pilots on this stuff and provide streamlined access. And as a fund, you know, we work with operators like Ryan. We work with other operators who are in industrial development and multifamily and mobile home parks. And we can sort of diversify across all sorts of different things. What we're able to do is leverage our economy of scale, so that by writing one big check, by aggregating capital together from a group of investors and writing a big check to, say, Ryan, well, Ryan and Spartan Investment Group is willing to say, you know, if I come in and say, hey, we really like your deal. We want to give you, you know, $2 million on it. Ryan's willing to say, okay, well, we'll give you a better split of the profit. Spartan will take a smaller split of the upside. We'll give you a bigger piece. And if there's anybody out there listening that has, you know, $1 million or $2 million to invest, they'll give you those deal, that same deal as well. But, you know, most of us don't have that. And even if we did, we wouldn't want to put it into a single deal. We'd want to spread it out over multiple. So this is a way where we can sort of create a win-win-win situation between an operator, our investors, and ourselves, where we can pool a bunch of money together, get a more favorable economics from a deal that we'd like to all invest in than we would investing $50,000 each or $100,000 each individually. Ryan's company and whoever, whatever other operator's company benefit, because if we can bring capital, then it means that they can do what they do best, which is find, operate, and optimize great real estate deals. And it's a win for our investors because they're able to invest in the same deals as they would be able to investing directly without experiencing any economic drag. And that's an important point that I like to make, because we do, at as a fund, we take a small portion of the upside. But because we're enjoying favorable economics at the deal level, we are able to take a small enough chunk of that that our investors usually get a better return by coming through us than they would be going direct to sponsors. So that's for that reason, we never hide our operators behind any sort of white curtain. You know, Ryan, when we've done deals with you, you're on the webinar, and anybody's more than welcome. And I encourage them to get on your list directly. But at the end of the day, we're able to sort of cherry pick opportunities and bring them to our investors. So as a fund, we operate as a capital partner, where we find and identify these opportunities and we pool capital. So that's kind of how the fund works. And I'm happy to get into the technicals or the fundamentals or the you know, how it works stuff if we want to go down that road.
Well, yeah, one thing that you said was you share who the operator is. And so
yes,
I want to pull on that thread a little bit, because it all starts with the operator, right? I
mean, 100%.
There's no deal without an operator. So if you're investing in something, doesn't matter what it is, if you're doing a syndication, the first thing in your mind is you got to go, okay, I met this guy named Tate. That's great. He's investing in this deal, but who's running the deal, right?
Exactly.
And that's why Tate does a good job of like, hey, this is the guy who's leading the team that's running the deal. Because
exactly.
That's the person who is leasing the tenant, doing the tenants, relationships, you know, the maintenance, the financial management, the reporting. And that's why they're a crucial member of the team. And so if you have a really, really strong operator and a bad deal, you know, or deal gone bad, you can have a good outcome potentially, right? Yeah. Or a better outcome than if you had a bad operator and a great deal, they completely screw up, right?
Absolutely.
So it's really important to understand who's at the helm of what you're doing.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, that's the first thing that we diligence. So there are two benefits of investing through a fund like ours, in my opinion. One is that we get favorable economics. Two is the level of due diligence, because Ryan and his team are going to go and do a ton of diligence on an opportunity before they decide to go do it, right? But we're also going to diligence it ourselves. And by, you know, leveraging our collective strength and putting all of our resources together, we can hire incredible board of advisors. Our CFO is incredible. So he's going to take their underwriting and stress test it. We're going to make sure that we really, really go deep on the diligence. The other thing is, you know, I can ask operators, whether they're Ryan or someone else, for way, way deeper levels of DD files than a one-off investor could. You know, if I ask for source documents for a feasibility study, you know, if I'm investing $50,000, they're just going to be like, you know, sorry, man, the information's in the deal room. Let us.
Yeah, go find it.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Go pound sand. Politely go pound sand. But, you know, if we're bringing multiple millions of dollars, we're going to expect a higher level of service in terms of access to diligence documents and track records and things like that. So anyway, that's one benefit of having the fund.
Yeah, the thing that you mentioned, documents, I want to dive into that. So
yeah.
What documents is someone going to expect to find? So when we're thinking about a syndication and you are thinking about placing funds, sure, you might not get every little nitty gritty document, but the minimum documents that you should come to find are the PPM, private placement memorandum.
Yep.
You're going to need that, the subscription agreement and the operating agreement. And then you'll have like an offering memorandum that is sort of the prospectus. So your OM or your offer memorandum is basically
or executive summary.
Yeah, that's your sales brochure. That's yep. That's the bottom line. It's, you know, hey, this is, you know, we're buying this property. Here's what we're going to do with it. And here's what you can expect in return. So it's a sales brochure. The PPM is the engine, right? That is like, right. You're getting out the maintenance records and you're seeing when the last time it had 100-hour and when it had its annual inspection and all the things that are going into it. And so the PPM is.
And it's also the disclosure document. You know, exactly. It's yep. Here are the 80 pages of how you could potentially lose your money.
Yep. Yeah. It's all the risks associated with the investment. The PPM is my personal favorite document. I read every word, especially when I'm putting my own investments together. And then when I'm investing in other people's syndications, the PPM basically is all the disclosures. And here's the thing about syndications. They're great. They have some downside, right? Because they're illiquid. You can't really call your cash. They pay outsized returns based on the market. They're uncorrelated typically to the stock market, which is great. But one downside of a syndication, or maybe an upside if you're an operator, is that it's kind of the discretion to the operator. I mean, you can't do anything fraudulent or against law, but you can kind of disclose and do what you say you disclose. So an operator can say, hey, we're going to do this with the cash. And if it says it in the operating agreement and the PPM, it's pretty much fair game. I mean, unless you're breaking a law or you're being fraudulent. So reading the PPM and what it says and understanding every word in there is super important to know what your operator has the discretion to do. Again, there's an episode we recorded like 3 or 4 ago that I talked about my investment with an operator who I read the PPM and there was some weird stuff in there and he didn't like want to talk about it. And he's like, oh, I don't read those things. Red flag.
Right, right.
So the operating agreement is the rules of the road for the partnership, right? That tells you the rules of the road. I mean, I can't simplify that anymore. Usually it mirrors kind of what the PPM does. And then the subscription agreement, it basically outlines the terms and conditions of the investment and it binds you to the offering. So like once you sign that, you sort of acknowledge that, hey, I've read everything. I understand everything. This is how much I'm going to invest. And this is the entity of the who I'm investing in. So, you know, if you have Tate Duryea LLC, or if you invest with your trust or an individual, you'll be putting that on the subscription agreement. And that's where the tax.
Let's talk through that, because this is a question that I get all the time is, you know, hey, should I invest individually? Do I need an LLC for this? Mm-hmm. Should I invest through my trust? Should I invest through... So because you're a limited partner, I always tell people that, you know, there's really no, you don't need any liability protection. And most LLCs are a flow through disregarded entity anyway. So I personally invest in my own name. When I invest in other people's syndications or my own syndications for that matter, I invest via Tate Duryea. I don't do it through a company or anything like that. Would you agree with that?
I do. And I'll just, the only tweak I'll make to that is I invest with my trust. So
right.
I invest in my living trust. So I have an estate plan. Clint Coons in episodes, I don't know, 5 or 6 episodes ago.
Anderson Advisors, yep.
Yep, talked all about estate plans. Get an estate plan and definitely have all your beneficiaries point to your trust, because that's what's going to be legally the best thing to do. So it's okay if you don't have one. Like, don't feel like you have to have all these things all sorted out. Start making investments and you can invest in your personal name. And then what we allow you to do at Spartan, if you want to change the name on your subscription agreement, we can just do the paperwork and switch it later. And that's totally acceptable. But yeah, I think a lot of people do a lot of brain damage on, oh, I need an LLC and then this LLC, then that LLC. Cause you know, what if something happens at the property level? Remember, you're a limited partner on the entity that's investing in the property. So you have limited partner. And I'll just, you know, disclaimer this whole thing with we're not giving a legal advice. This is just kind of a friendly conversation of what Tate and I do and our general understanding of it. So, you know, talk to your attorney about it and see what makes the most sense for you. just keep in mind that attorneys like to sell you LLCs a little bit. So, you know, four or five more that now they have to maintain for you and all that stuff, right? So just know that a lot of our investors just do personal names and or trusts. I think that's the most common that I see. Yeah.
Unless you have, you know, a business that actually files its own tax return and you want that business to make the investment, I don't see there really being any need for an LLC between you and the passive investment.
Yeah. All right. Don't go chasing waterfalls.
Let's talk about waterfalls. We got a little bit into preferred return earlier, but let's unpack it further.
Yeah, I feel like we should play that song. So waterfalls are how you get paid. You know, that's like the coolest thing, right? So a waterfall in a syndication is basically outlining the order in which profits are dispersed and how much of the profits the partner is entitled to, essentially, when there is profit, right? It doesn't guarantee you anything. Nothing is guaranteed. But basically, the typical waterfall structure is that limited partners or you, the investor, receive a percentage of the profits first, and then the general partner gets profits after that. And there's different ways that waterfalls can be structured. And the explicit terms for the structuring of the waterfall is going to be specific to the investment.
And it'll be laid out in the operating agreement.
Exactly.
And it should match what's in the OM, the offering memorandum, or the executive summary. Big red flag if the executive summary says something and the operating agreement says something different.
Yeah, because guess what really matters? The operating agreement.
Exactly.
Right? So the operating agreement, remember the sales brochure is just the sales brochure. And the webinar is just the webinar, right? Any marketing you see, any videos you see, any webinars you watch, that stuff doesn't matter. They could say whatever they want. Well, they could get in trouble, but they could say whatever you want. Really, the brass tacks is the PPM and the operating agreement. So just keep that in mind.
So each level of the waterfall is usually referred to as a hurdle. So the first hurdle is typically a preferred return. We've already kind of unpacked that. Ryan, you want to talk about some additional hurdles in the waterfall?
Yeah, just to keep it simple, because I you know, the hurdle, you know, it gets confusing and preferred return and all this stuff, a waterfall, what is this? Just imagine we do a deal and I say, hey, I'm going to split everything with you 50-50. That's your waterfall, is a 50% split, right? So if I just say, hey, for every dollar that comes in, I get 50 cents, you get 50 cents. That's the hurdle, or that's the waterfall.
That's the waterfall, that's it.
That's it. Now, when most syndications typically have a preferred return. And so now I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to give you a hurdle that the investment has to achieve before I split something with you. So the first hurdle in the waterfall could be a preferred return of 8%. So as soon as I get that 8% preferred return as an investor, then it splits with the sponsor. So let's say there's one investor for 100 grand. They have $8,000 that's coming to them. And let's say there's $2,000 more to distribute. And let's say the waterfall has an 8% preferred return hurdle. And then everything after that is split 50-50. So the investor would get $8,000. And then there's $2,000 remaining to split. So I would get the operator would get $1,000. The investor would get $1,000. So the investor is getting $9,000. The operator is only getting $1,000. So that is a basic hurdle rate. Now, it gets a little more confusing than that. And we're not going to go through every single type of hurdle. And, you know, and people always ask me, like, what's fair and what's not fair and what's common and all that. And nothing really. It's all over the map.
Totally depends. Yeah.
Totally depends. You know, there might be three hurdles or four hurdles or five hurdles. So it gets really confusing pretty quickly. But I just wanted to, like, you know, we just want to kind of lay the foundation of what a waterfall is, what a hurdle is, and why does it matter?
And I think just to tack on one nuance here, you know, the most common additional hurdle that I see is an IRR hurdle or an internal rate of return. So it's like 8% pref, and then let's say a 70-30 or an 80-20, and then the operator says, okay, but if we make you 17% annualized return on your money, then after that, it reverts to a 50-50. And that's usually one that we avoid as a fund. You know, mostly, most of the time, Retail investors are getting hit with that hurdle. So if the deal performs really well, the operator is handsomely rewarded for that. But by investing a large dollar amount, we very oftentimes will have no additional hurdle and we'll carry that 80-20 all the way up, no matter how well the deal performs.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's a good point. And the other thing too, you might hear the word promote. Like, what is the promote? Mm-hmm. That's a very common, saying, and that's basically the percentage of profits that's dispersed to the general partner after the hurdle rate has been met. So
it's a fancy way of saying it's the 20 in the 80-20.
Yeah, it's what they own, right? It's kind of like the last split in all the hurdle rates, right? And that's the promote. So like if they say, oh, what's your promote? And the 50-50 promote. Whoa, that's pretty favorable to the operator, right? 70-30 is probably the most common. 70% to the investor, 30% to the operator. And again, it depends on the deal, right? I don't want to get into that.
Of course. But if you ever see a 60-40, 70-30, 80-20, it's always in favor of the investor. Unless you're dealing with some really, really small deal, it's always in favor of the investors.
Yeah. So let's talk about how an investor or how an operator decides like when somebody gets paid out. So you have two different types of ways you're going to get paid, to kind of simplify this. You have operating distributions, and then you have something called liquidity events. So imagine this. Imagine you buy a self-storage facility and it produces profit. And every month we look at the P&L, profit and loss statement, and decide, hey, this has some cash that we can distribute to you, the investor. Those are operating returns from operating the business. And there's a waterfall for operating returns. So when that $1 comes out, how is it split? Well, there's an 8% pref, let's say, and a 50-50 split thereafter. Okay, that's your operating distribution waterfall. So that's how we handle cash flow from operations. But the other side of this is a thing called liquidity events. So what happens if you buy a self-storage facility and there's a car wash on the front, right? Right, Tate, like our deal?
That's right.
And there's an so there's a self-storage business and then there's maybe a separate parcel with a car wash. Your liquidity event waterfall would specify how you would handle selling a portion of the business. Liquidity event is also like another term for it is like cash events. So right. In this case, we bought a self-storage and then we had a car wash. When we sold the car wash, that wasn't operating returns from the business. It was a sale event. It was a liquidity event. So in that case, there was a separate waterfall that was specified in our PPM on how to treat that cash. And so in Tate's case, we had to, when we sold, because he was the passive investor, we were the operator. When we sold that car wash, those funds first had to go to pay expenses. Of course, you know, satisfy the lender, satisfy any expenses. But after all expenses were satisfied, Tate would have to be made up for any deficiency in his preferred return through that date and time. So he got a chunk of cash to make up the preferred return because we hadn't been hitting it till that point. And then the next step in the liquidity waterfall was we had to return his initial investment. So he got back about $19,000 or so per 50K invested. And then after that, after his original capital account was, or his initial investment was returned in full, then there would be splits with the operator, right? So wildly in his favor. So just understand this. Yeah.
And let's fully unpack this because this deal is selling.
Yeah.
This month, right?
Yep.
So there was a liquidity event. Liquidity events can be, basically three things. So a portion of the property is sold off during the hold. There's a refinance where it's a cash out refinance and we get larger loan proceeds and there's actually distributable cash through a refinance, which can be very favorable. And then also a sale of the entire thing, right? So there was no refinance during the hold period on this thing, but we got a nice windfall of cash from that car wash selling. Let's talk through the actual sale, right? So as the passive investor, I got $19,000 or something back. I've been cash flowing, I don't know, around 10% on this thing, 10, 12%. It's been great, just passive income for the last few years, but it just sold or it's just selling, right? So what happens now?
Yeah. So when it sells, that's a liquidity event, right? That's a cash event. That's the closing of the business. So Tate is still getting his cash flow every single month. And when the business sells, we're going to have to say, okay, we're going to go back to the liquidity event waterfall. And the first step, it's going to say, we have to make sure that he's caught up on his preferred return payments. And he is. Right. So we check that box. Then we have to say, okay, now we have to return his initial investment. Well, we've already sent back $19,000. So now we have to send back the $31,000 of his capital account balance or his initial investment account balance that still remains. Okay, great. So then we send that back. And then after that, any excess cash that we have, in this instance, that was a 50-50 split. So we split the remaining cash 50-50 with Tate. So he's been rewarded with cash flow and a preferred return. And when there's liquidity events, he's getting paid back first and profits first. And now it's our time actually to celebrate a little bit, right? As an operator,
right, we're
actually
doing all the hard work.
Yeah, we're going to start making money. This is four and a half years into the deal. And that's what you want. I want to go on a little bit of a tangent about that, because you don't want an operator who doesn't stand to benefit, right? At some point, your fairness can only go so far where you actually start, you want your operator to be successful. So they'll go do more deals like this, stay motivated in your project, right? So,
well, and it goes both ways. You know, you don't want a deal where the operator is compensated, whether it goes well or not, where there's a huge acquisition fee up front. And they're just like, I'm walking away with 5% of the capital stack. I don't care how this deal goes.
Yep.
But you also don't want it so that where the promote is so skinny that they're not motivated to go down there to Texas and make sure it's operated well.
Right. Exactly. Yep. So there's a balance there, right? And Tate and his team and my team, we can help you kind of walk the dog on some things that you see on that. So
absolutely.
Yeah. So that's good. So, you know, when you go to the PPM, I want you just to do a control F, a control find, and just type the words in plan of distribution. In our PPMs, it's section 10, so section X, and you'll see operating distribution waterfall, and then you'll see liquidity event waterfall, and then it'll specify exactly how the cash is handled in those two different types of events. So if you can't find that, that's like if there's one thing that you look for, I mean, I understand, like, you're not going to, maybe you don't want to look through 150 pages of a PPM. Please look at the plan of distribution. Please understand how you're compensated. And I think it's not a bad idea. Grab a syndication attorney or somebody who's familiar with seeing these transactions and go to them and say, hey, I want to explain to you how I think this is supposed to go. And then you tell me if I'm right.
That's right? Such a good idea.
If you ask them to explain it, they're going to be like, blah, 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 blah. And they're going to do this attorney speak. You're probably going to be more confused. But if you go to them and you say, hey, I read this and this is how I understand it. Am I correct? That's a great way of them to say, you don't understand this at all. Let me try to explain it. Or yes, that, you know, you do understand it. So that's very good. So
I think that's the soundbite for the intro.
Yeah, exactly. I like it. Yeah. So let's talk about these syndications. They're not registered. Okay, so let's kind of get into that. You know, there's registered securities and there's unregistered securities. And that's just a fancy way of saying the SEC either approves or disapproves, like a registered security. Obviously, if it's disapproved, it's not approved. But or it's unregistered and it's not approved or disapproved by the SEC. So
it falls under an exemption.
It's an exemption, right? Like exemption, what's an aviation exemption? 25
question. Well, I don't know, but I've been sleeping and breathing 506 B and C with you for the last 5 years.
Exactly. Yeah. So like an airplane flying, right? Like if you're a new captain under 100 hours, there might be
5549. There you go.
5549. There we go. Yeah. So it's like you can land the airplane if you have so many hours and the visibility and the wind and the conditions, right? Then you can have an exemption, right? To drop below those minimums, right? 5549. And I think there's a few others for alternate airports and things like that. And so the SEC has the same thing. They have an exemption that allows people to go raise money and it not be a registered security so long as they follow some rules. And so when you're in this space, you're going to hear two very common exemptions, right? 5549, like in flying, 506B and 506C. And they're under Regulation D of the Security and Exchange Commissions Act, right? Of 1940. Right. Yeah.
Exactly. So the 506B yeah. has been around since 1933. The 506C was created in 2012.
Yep.
With the Obama Jobs Act.
Yeah. So Tate's first deal with me was actually done under 506B. And so 506B used to be this really popular exemption. It still is. It's still very, very popular. Trillions of dollars are raised under 506B and 506C and Regulation D in general. So you have to know, you have to have a pre-existing relationship with somebody. And that's like the most gray area ever. Like what does that mean?
Big time.
Yeah.
And to go back, I mean, this is why I think, you know, most of the time when I'm talking about syndications, people tend to kind of say, this sounds too good to be true. Like, why haven't I heard about this? And I explained, well, because before 2012, I couldn't tell you about it unless I already knew you. So they ended up being country club deals. Like operators, GP, LP, real estate projects have been going on for a long, long time. They've been these country club deals where people have an investor list and the deals go well and those people reinvest and, you know, the rich get richer and there it is, right? 2012 ushered in this new era of crowdfunding. And what it was supposed to do was to democratize this industry and let more people, sort of middle class accredited investors, invest in these private placements. And a bunch of online capital raising, crowdfunding, real estate crowdfunding platforms popped up. And that was going to change the landscape where people were just going to, you know, a few clicks on the internet and invest 50K and participate in real estate deals. And that really didn't take place. It didn't happen that way because it turns out when people are investing 50 or 100 grand, they like to have a relationship with who they're investing with, right? So although 506Cs allow for general solicitation, which means that you can talk about your deal publicly to people that you don't know, typically we know our investors. So yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to derail you too much there, but just wanted to touch on sort of the history there and the difference between the two. So yeah, the first deal that we did, Ryan, was under a 506B. Everything you raise under now is 506C, which means that all investors have to be accredited in 506Cs, which is the direction we're going as well.
Yeah. And if you're an investor and you're listening to all this and you're just like, man, what's the so what here? It doesn't really matter, right? Right. Just know that, you know, these operators are not registered, right? And that's okay. You know, you might read some verbiage that says, this offering is neither disapproved or approved by the SEC. It just means that they haven't looked at it to approve it or deny it. It's just, it's an exemption that it doesn't have to be approved. Yeah.
And it's important to note that there are vastly more unregistered securities sold in the United States every year than there are registered. And there are only two options. You either IPO, which costs millions and millions of dollars, or you fall under an exemption. That's it. So
yeah.
Anyway.
And it could take years. And the reason why we don't register is because literally, if you're going to register your security, it could take years. I have to buy this property in 2 months. I don't have years to go public on a $3 million property, right? So, and that I don't own yet, right? So it's necessary for small business. And here's the thing too, capital raises are not limited to real estate. There's people who have Broadway shows, restaurants, random, you know, car company, you know, anything can go under a 506B or C solicitation, you know, angel fund, you know, angel crowdfunding, you know, it's all that, all that stuff can go under 506C. Now when you are 506B, you don't have to be accredited, but you do have to be sophisticated, which is basically a fancy way of saying you have to reasonably be able to assess and understand the offering. So 506B, you've got to know the guy or gal, and you have to be sophisticated, but you don't have to be accredited. 506C, you can advertise it to the world or generally solicit, and you have to be accredited. And so an accredited investor, there is no like certification you go through. You just get a letter that basically says you meet the definition of an accredited investor.
That letter doesn't just come in the mail either. This is, it's very, you're like, how do I know if I, well, it's very, underwhelming. When you hit that threshold, nobody pops a bottle of champagne for you. It's just if you've made over $200,000 a year for the past 2 years if you're single, $300,000 a year as a married couple for the previous 2 years of earned income, or very important that it's not both, it's or $1 million net worth excluding your primary residence. You qualify as an accredited investor. And so you can go on to verifyinvestor.com, pay $59 and upload some documents, and they'll issue you a letter, or you can get a boilerplate from either Ryan and I and have your CPA or attorney fill it out. They'll probably do that for free for you because it'll take them 30 seconds and you return it to us. That letter is good for 5 years. We hang it in your file for compliance, and it's good for any future investments with either of us.
Yeah, and again, if you're listening to this going, oh my God, that sounds like a lot of work. It's not. It's really not. Like in our portal, Literally it's a couple of clicks. You upload a couple of things and then you get a letter for free.
Yeah. We get the same thing.
Yeah. So it's so easy to get. And then like Tate was saying, good for 5 years, really easy to have. So let's talk about, kind of the due diligence process a little bit. I mean, I know that's like a whole nother topic, but I wanted to kind of just wrap it up with that. I love telling people like, so here's my personal philosophy on anything I do in life. If you don't have a website and like 10 or so employees, it doesn't have to be 10 employees, but like a good social media presence, or I can find you online, I can see who you are, I can write a review, I can do it. I'm not doing business with you if I can't see that.
Yeah.
So if you don't have a track record, at least digitally.
And he's talking about investing with real estate operators here.
Exactly. It's like you call a plumber, right? And you kind of want to call not the most expensive guy that you see billboards all over town on, but like somebody who's at least got a legitimate like truck and van and a staff that can come back right. If they kind of screw it up, right? If it's like such the hole in wall guy, right? Like right. you're probably rolling the dice a little bit. It might be a little bit cheaper or whatever, but I feel the same way about investing in syndications. Like I need to be able to go out into the interweb, figure out who you are, figure out who's invested with you, and ideally kind of get in touch with somebody who's invested with you and find a referral without asking for it. And that's when you know you're investing with an operator who's got like a good track record and is kind of standing the test of time. It doesn't guarantee anything, but it just gives you a little bit more sense of like, find somebody who's done some deals and don't take their word for it, in other
Definitely.
Words. Yeah.
The best way that I can put this all together and wrap it all up is, investing in real estate on your own, going out and buying your own rental properties is like flying a 172 or Bonanza on the weekend. Investing in a syndication is like buying a ticket on an airline with a professionally flown professional pilots. What we do at Turbine is we line check pilots, we boroscope engines, we do low cell audits. We go out, we go really, really deep on that diligence of the aircraft, the flight crew, the airline, and then we cherry pick the best routes to fly on, essentially. So that's kind of the best way that I can tie it together. And then we're the travel agent because we sell a bunch of tickets on the rides that we like.
Nice. Well, we're the airline. And
you are the airline.
We're the airline. We're operating everything. So
you're the operator.
So fly
exactly.
Us. Yeah. So we hope this was helpful. We do have a link in the show notes to a Passive Investing 101 book. And we're going to be doing more episodes like this where we just kind of just break down the basics. If you're an advanced listener, maybe you learned something new, but thanks for following along. If you're just learning and you need to watch this on 1.0x speed, that's good too. So
absolutely. Yeah. Just wanted to bring this value to the airline pilots, and almost midnight on a layover right now. I love that we have this platform and we can share this knowledge with everyone. The feedback that everybody's giving us is incredible. So thank you for listening. And if you're enjoying it, please, I don't want to see it so cliche to say like and subscribe, but if you can, please leave us a review, share it with your friends. It really helps us expand our reach and help more people.
Thanks, everybody. Catch you on the next one.
See you next time.